see these strategic hamlets, and I have pictures of them, and as we went past, we would see them. I never went into any, but I could see that for the local people, they were a joke. Mm-hmm. Because there'd be a strategic hamlet, and the people, some people would be living in it, and some people would be living out of it. It was totally compromised. Mm-hmm. Totally, because you can't put everybody in a rice paddy area. This is a thickly populated area. It may work in the highlands where you could round up the few people that were and put them in one, but it didn't work there. Because they were, like all Vietnamese, you want to say they're corrupt or whatever you want to say, they're compromisers. I mean, they're, whatever system you're going to impose on them, they're going to find a way of getting around it. And they did. They took the money, built the hamlets, and then lived as they pleased. When Colonel Fook came, they probably got in the hamlet. When he was gone, they probably didn't. You know what I mean?
You mentioned that Colonel Fook once was in the habit of displaying dead VC bodies. Was that?
Well, yes, this is one of the other... did I say that?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. No, in your form.
Okay, yeah, that was one of the more disturbing things because the soccer field, the town soccer field, was right next to the normal school, next to the Chung Supam. And the girls' dormitories were there because the girls were sequestered. They were not permitted to live in the town. Mm-hmm. The boys could live in the town. They did, and they lived around in different houses, little rooms they rented, and real fun to visit them because it was like all college boys living on their own, you know, they were fun. The girls lived in these dormitories. Well, in the soccer field right next door, when there was a big VC victory, or a big Vietnamese army victory, they would display the bodies on the soccer field, and this happened a couple times. And they would lay them out there, and then in the hot tropical sun, they would stay there for 2 or 3 days, and the smell would waft over to the school. I mean, this is really gross, you know, but they were showing the people in their crude, I mean, it's like Genghis Khan, you know, methods, and we're showing, we're winning, this is what happens to you if you're a VC. God only knows how many of them were VC and how many would just happen to have on their black pajamas that day, you know. But anyway, this was disturbing. And the other thing, the only other impact in town that you could see was sometimes I would go with friends up on top of my building. I had a nice little rooftop, and which is ordinary, and I had a canvas bed up there where we could sit. And at night, you could see napalm attacks off in the distance. We weren't close enough to hear the noise, but you could see the planes come down and see the flash of napalm. Well, I knew that, you know, I mean, they were just indiscriminately bombing. A VC village, how do you tell the VC from the others? By the time the plane comes up, they're all crispy critters. That was disturbing, although in a way it was scary. And romantic in a way, because I mean it's action, but it's war that doesn't touch you. You don't feel any discomfort from it. There were a couple times when Binh Long, they thought Binh Long itself was threatened, and the word would sort of go around the grapevine and keep a tight ship, but nothing ever happened. And when we went to Cantab on the road, we were always
that's
told
Cantho.
Yeah, C-A-N, new word, T-H-O. And then when we went to Cantab by road, we were told to go fast. The principal would occasionally take his Land Rover. Usam bought Land Rover to Cantha to visit the other principal, I guess. I'd go along. He'd help invite me. One of the other fun things about being in Vietnam at this time was that I could fly on any military aircraft free. And this was just loads of fun. Flying was one of the most fun parts of being in Vietnam at this time because I could fly in Huey helicopters. I just go out to the Binh Long airfield and say, here I am, I want to go to Saigon. From Saigon, if I wanted to go someplace, I had to usually make out a form or something. But sometimes we went Air Vietnam. Like when we had our Christmas gathering, every year, which was wonderful, in Da La, which is cool, wonderful climate to escape the humidity. And the IVS had a big villa there. I don't know how they got this. Jeez, they had a big villa.
There was an interesting process by which they got it, but it was they basically abandoned and they rented it.
Yeah, it was probably another former French one.
It's more complicated than that, but French, I have a question. Did you ever go to a barbecue on that Christmas holiday?
Yes.
Because there's, you know, an apocryphal IVS, you know, like urban myth. That's where Madame Nu, who had a place across from the villa, got the word barbecue, so that when she said, "Oh, it's nothing but a bunch of barbecuing Buddhists,"
Well, I don't know if she got the word there, but I do. I was at that barbecue.
Uh-huh.
We had a Christmas barbecue, and we were doing hot dogs and hamburgers, mm-hmm. American style. And we, Madame New's villa backed up to ours, mm-hmm. the yards backed up, and we got word that she would like to be invited.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Don Luce invited her mm-hmm. To come over.
This would be Christmas of 62, you think?
Probably.
Your first Christmas?
Or 63, I don't know which.
Well, Christmas of 63 would be too late for the purposes of
that
story.
Right. The news
so it must have been 62, though.
Yeah. And, of course, lots of delightful place. Mm-hmm. Rhododendrons climbing up the trees, mm-hmm. and we went on elephant rides.
Did you meet Madame New? Did you?
And so Madame New came over to the barbecue, and I remember her exquisitely, because mm-hmm. She was just a perfect picture of a strikingly beautiful Vietnamese woman,
mm-hmm.
All dressed in black. She had on, I remember she had on black elbow-length leather gloves. And as she was, she wanted to do everything the American way, so she was roasting her weenie over the fire and her buns, and then she spread her mustard, and she got mustard on her black gloves,
mm-hmm.
and she was doing her hot dog, and I thought that was just delightful.
Was she fastidious about cleaning it up?
Yes. Well, she brought along an aide or uh-huh. somebody with her, but she was, she made quite an impression, and her mm-hmm. her English is broken in just exactly the right places
mm-hmm.
to be just charming as hell,
mm-hmm.
and she was straight out of Terry and the Pirates.
Mm-hmm.
So after that, we called her the Dragon Lady.
Uh-huh.
You know, that was her, became her name,
mm-hmm.
Because she was perfect.
Mm-hmm.
She was perfect. She could, Terry and the Pirates must have, you know, I don't know, they couldn't have patterned, because they're
no,
older.
It was earlier.
They're
yeah.
old, uh-huh. but she was perfect.
speaking of actually Madame New, you were there when Ngo Dinh Diem was assassinated. Do you
yes,
remember
I happened to be in Saigon.
Uh-huh.
I was in Saigon to do some dental work and catch up on things on some school holiday.
Mm-hmm.
And I was downtown, halfway downtown the dentist office when mm-hmm. the coup d'etat started. And
mm-hmm.
the tanks started coming into town, and the word came on the radio that there was going to be some action. And my dentist was a Vietnamese young lady who would learned her dentistry at some Midwestern university in the U.S.,
uh-huh.
Michigan, I think, again. And she was very good, and she told me that I'd better get out of town. I was very lucky. I went right out on the street and got a taxi. I think it was the only taxi around, because mm-hmm. everybody was heading for the hills.
Right.
And then shortly thereafter, the fireworks started. And some of our IBS people were caught downtown and mm-hmm. had to spend the night below the windows.
Mm-hmm.
But I made it back to the IBS house, and then the next day we all went downtown to see what had happened. It was all over very quickly,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and the rumors were flying right and left, and the rumor was that if you went downtown, they would let you into the palace area, and that turned out to be true, because I went downtown, we looked around, and the shot-up tanks were sitting around, when the soldiers were on them, and the old Bobs were coming around giving them candy and lychee nuts and things,
mm-hmm.
thinking that this was a good event.
Mm-hmm.
But they had a cordon off the area. But if you were a round eye, mm-hmm. They would let you in.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went into the palace grounds, and then somebody said, well, if you go around to the back door of the palace, they'll give you a flag, for instance. And this tells the sort of the spirit of the thing was euphoria. Everybody mm-hmm. was just gloriously happy. They didn't know this was really the beginning of the end instead of the end of something
Or the beginning of a new beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I went around to the back door, and there was a little soldier there standing, and just, I think, entirely on his own initiative,
mm-hmm.
was standing there, and you tell him the country you were from, he'd give you a flag from that country. Just hand you a flag.
Mm-hmm.
It was the flag warehouse.
Mm-hmm.
Probably totally paid for by USOM. flags for parades, for all occasions, you know, mm-hmm. were provided. So I told him that I was an American, and he went and got me a big American flag. I mean, it's a big flag. I still have it.
Mm-hmm.
That flag is from President Diem's palace.
Mm-hmm.
And I flew it when John F. Kennedy was assassinated. I flew it off my balcony. I didn't care who would be damned.
Mm-hmm.
I flew it in the appropriate backwards position for a death of a president.
Mm-hmm.
And I still have it.
Mm. Did you see, you know, wasn't there some massive looting of the palace? Well, it would have happened before, though, you got there.
I didn't see any of that.
So that guy was really handing out what was left.
But it was all very orderly.
Yeah, yes.
No, totally orderly. Yeah. They had all cordoned. I didn't know about any looting of the palace.
I think so, yeah.
Because this was the next day, mm-hmm. in the clear, bright sunshine.
Mm-hmm. And so what you just mentioned, you thought it was the beginning of the end that Ziem.
Well, I saw Ziem as being at least order. He represented order mm-hmm. at the time, and he was sort of a benign father of many things. He would go out and inspect these projects and officially approve them. And mm-hmm. I mean, he was just kind of a figurehead, but at least he represented to the people. He represented order and an eye for progress, at least mm-hmm. in a public works sort of way. Mm-hmm. With American money, he was doing things for the country. Mm-hmm. Only later did I find out all the things that were being done in his name by Mr. New and by his brother and mm-hmm. I guess it's his sister and brother-in-law. Yeah, mm-hmm. sister and brother-in-law.
No, it's brother and sister-in-law.
Brother and sister-in-law. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. She couldn't be that pretty and be his sister, because he was such a solid mm-hmm. Buddhist-looking character. Although he was very Catholic.
Well, since time is short, how did you? How did your period with IBS come to an end?
Well, I fulfilled my contract mm-hmm. and then came home. I packed up everything, shipped out. I had many valuable things mm-hmm. that I thought valuable at the time, and I had for my vacations. I traveled all over, and I fulfilled my objectives, mm-hmm. and I think I did a good job. Mm-hmm.
You weren't thinking of re-upping or anything like that.
You
accomplished what you wanted to do.
I had seen a new part of the world. Mm-hmm. I had experienced it, but the feeling of a young person at that time being in Vietnam for 2 years was one of being stuck out of the action. Mm-hmm. You see. All my friends were going to graduate school. They were all getting somewhere. And here I was stuck.
You were stuck?
Stuck.
In Vietnam.
little did I know that when I came home, of course, I was going to be an authority on Vietnam, and I was invited to speak here and there, uh-huh. which was kind of a nice dividend. Uh-huh. But I wasn't going anywhere, uh-huh. you see. I was stuck in this backwater. Mm-hmm. I applied for University of Oregon mm-hmm. while I was there, and I applied to Cal. To go to graduate school in sociology. Mm-hmm. Cal sent me a form letter saying, "Dear foreign student." So I carefully explained what I was doing there. Yeah. And University of Oregon sent me a telegram, which I still have. Mm-hmm. A telegram I got in Nha Trang at a temporary address. Mm-hmm. I said, "Come and this first little notice said, come and get your cable." And I got on my bicycle and went down and got my cable at the post office, and it said I'd gotten a teaching assistantship at the University of Oregon in mm-hmm. sociology. Although I'd never taken any sociology beyond the introductory course, and would you please come and report to so-and-so? Mm-hmm. So when I came back, I was going to be a professor, and I went into sociology. Mm-hmm. Well, that's one of the more fun moments, too, to get in Vietnam, in this backwater, in a temporary town, in a beach mm-hmm. town, mm-hmm. go on your bicycle downtown and get a cable telling you that you've got a graduate fellowship.
Mm-hmm. And so did you get it going for a PhD in sociology?
I was going to do that mm-hmm. when... I got disenchanted with sociology. Mm-hmm. I had a good time there. I liked Eugene, Oregon, mm-hmm. and a couple things happened. My girlfriend from high school was going to Oregon State, and I got reconnected with her, mm-hmm. and we both decided to go back into teaching. And so, I took a job in Pacific Grove, California, mm-hmm. and she took a job in Carmel, mm-hmm. and we headed south. So things changed, but I got disenchanted with the world of, the first time I got disenchanted with the world of academia, mm-hmm. I got tired of the pretense mm-hmm. of the gamesmen played, and I wanted to do something real. Mm-hmm. I was an idealistic young person.
If I may say so, that's the way I felt about anthropology when I started out as an anthro major. It just didn't, there wasn't enough meat for me.
Yeah.
That's why I
wanted to do. I wanted to go overseas in education or something else and help. Mm-hmm. You know, and but this time the bottom was dropping out of that, and things were changing rapidly. So I decided to go back into teaching. Mm-hmm. That was the first time I decided to go back into teaching. Then a few years later, I went into SciDec at Stanford in anthropology.
SciDec?
SciDec was the Stanford Institute for the Development of Education, mm-hmm. or Educational Development, something like that. Mm-hmm. And it was a new group started by Paul Hanna, and very wonderful idea. Mm-hmm. Again, it was to help. It was specifically what I wanted, and I was going to go be trained there and then go overseas in development work and help with elementary education. I've always been concerned with elementary education. All economic development is given at the higher level for mostly, and they don't pay attention to elementary school. And so I was very focused on that, and I thought that was really important. And they liked my ideas, and so I was accepted there. And then it turned out I saved up money and went from Pacific Grove. I only taught Pacific Grove 2 years. Lovely little town. I could have stayed there forever. But I wanted to go further in the world. This is about the end of my very idealistic period, I think. Stanford seemed perfect at this, so I went there for 2 years. And when I arrived, I received good news that I had received a full fellowship from the Ford Foundation and Institute of International Development Education or something. And that was renewed the following year. So I actually made money going to graduate school. They paid everything. Everything. I had, you know.
So what did you what did you finish your graduate work?
Well,
in?
So then once again, by getting towards, I worked in anthropology, and we had our special seminars in development education with many wonderful professors. But on the whole, it was also full of pretense. I think if one professor had taken me in hand and said, "This is," I kept waiting for the mysteries to be revealed. I kept saying, well, if you get up high enough in the graduate school, somebody must be going to sit down with you and say, now this is what the game is all about, and this is what you do. Nobody ever did that. Everybody was so busy sitting on their prestige and promoting their own little asses upwards. And my key professor was a statistician, not Mr. Hart. And I don't know, so I decided, and then it was the time of Nixon. Our foreign aid totally changed from doing anything positive to all military. We were, Latin America was one of my had two interest areas, Middle America and Southeast Asia. I speak Spanish and I was interested in Central America. I went to Costa Rica, I did my, all my coursework, I did my languages, did everything for the PhD. And I went to Costa Rica. I did anthropological training in Mexico in Oaxaca. Wonderful
I
summer.
Love Oaxaca.
Under the National Science Foundation. Wonderful summer. And then I went to Costa Rica, where I entertained the guy who later became the Dean of the School of Education, Dr. Coladarchi. He just died recently. And I went all around the country and selected my village where I was going to do my research. My research was going to be Costa Rica as an example of good elementary school development. And I was going to do this little town, Zarcero, and its school, and write it up. And it would have been interesting and made maybe some real contribution. Maybe somebody wouldn't have filed it away forever. How elementary school, when a country puts its resources into basics like elementary schools, it really helps the whole country move up. But then
something which even our country can't seem to grasp.
Yes, California cannot seem to grasp it. But the bottom fell out of that, and there was no more money in development education work. We started putting it in the military. I could see that I would end up teaching at some small Midwestern university, not in a field I wanted to be in, and I didn't want to do that. I wanted to be out in the field working. So I went back to teaching again, and I've been there ever since.
Here in the United States, and you're still teaching?
Yes.
Where
so I just sort of cynically picked. I picked my communities. I said, well, where do you want to be in the world? And I applied to Santa Cruz and a few other places, and Sunnyvale was the first to offer. And so I came to school in Sunnyvale, came to work in Sunnyvale. I've been teaching in Sunnyvale ever since. And on the whole, very happy.
And unbeknownst to you, Vietnam came to Sunnyvale.
Unbeknownst to me, Vietnam came to San Jose. At least they haven't quite reached Sunnyvale yet.
Close enough.
There are about four places within a mile you can go have pho. opening more all the time. And many Vietnamese people here, and like you say, you don't have to go to Vietnam anymore. It's come here. Though, speaking of that, probably one of your questions, I definitely want to go back to Vietnam. I'm planning now to go back as soon as I retire, because I don't want to go back in the summertime. I want to go back when I can spend.
When will you be retiring?
Two more years, I retire.
Well, I know you'll enjoy it, and I've certainly enjoyed this conversation, and I wish we had more time, and maybe I'll come back to you with some questions later on specific things.
Feel free to call and go over it. As you know, this could go on for ages. I don't get to talk about Vietnam very often, but when I do, You can obviously you can see from this Vietnam, this period of my life has been very important to my personal development. Mm-hmm. I feel very much that I got just as much as I gave over there, and I hope I've been an impact to some of the students I had. I hope that sometime I'll meet them and find out what they remember. Mm-hmm. Shortly after I left, was not the time to correspond. It was. After that time, after 75 especially, you couldn't correspond with Americans from Vietnam, and so I lost contact with everybody.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel? I mean, what were your emotions when the war ended in 75?
Well, when the war ended and I got home, then my eyes were opened much wider as to what we were really doing there, and I became very anti-war, and I marched in several San Francisco marches. Mm-hmm. And University of Oregon, we had that wonderful Senator Morse.
Mm-hmm.
You've read about him. Well, he put on a program, and I was on the program with my slides and my tapes and stuff, and I presented about Vietnam.
Well, what was your anti-war belief? What was it based on?
That we really had no business being there.
Uh-huh.
Domino theory be damned, the people were better off without our bombs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were helping to destroy a country.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a matter of right or left,
mm-hmm.
it was a matter of destruction of a culture, of a people.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, the Vietnamese people are very, very resilient,
mm-hmm.
and of course, utterly, one of the most remarkable things about them is they still like Americans.
Mm-hmm.
They must have, all I can say is there must have been a tremendous number of individual contacts with individually generous Americans
mm-hmm.
and romantic, wonderful Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
There must have been enough connections
mm-hmm.
in this manner to overcome all of the cruelty.
Do you think IBS may have played a part in that?
Oh, definitely,
mm-hmm.
definitely. When I meet Vietnamese here now, some of them, they know people who knew people who were in IBS.
Mm-hmm.
The Volunteers in America group, Volunteers in Asia
mm-hmm.
group continued it. And there are many of the language classes which were sponsored by USAM, but
mm-hmm.
taught by volunteers. That's what they remember. The Vietnamese have very long memories.
Mm-hmm.
And there, I feel very strongly that there is a cultural affinity between Vietnamese culture and American culture. It's strange, I mean, being so separate in some ways. But the Vietnamese are one of the most open peoples in Southeast Asia. They are open to new ideas in many cases. And they have their spirit and the American spirit melds very well. I don't know why. But there are certain things that work between Vietnamese and Americans.
Mm-hmm.
I think that has helped us. But I totally opposed what the war was doing as soon as I got home.
So how did you feel about IVS's continued presence in Vietnam? Do you think that they were still trying to do good under bad conditions?
Yes. Yeah, I think they could stay as long as they could.
Mm-hmm.
Because you see, every time an IVSer goes out and shows understanding of the country, he counter-affects your southern military officer who can't even say Vietnam correctly.
Mm-hmm. But I guess there's a side issue, which is, would IVSers showing that America was good and doing things that show indirectly, because you're working actually for the Vietnamese government, that the Vietnamese government cares for them, and that is in essence part of the war effort on one side as opposed to the other?
I never felt that way.
Mm-hmm.
Because I felt really what was much more important was the cultural contact.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that history has shown that to be correct,
mm-hmm.
because the cultural contact is what has been preserved.
Mm-hmm.
Vietnamese still like
mm-hmm.
Americans and American things,
mm-hmm.
and even though all of the crap,
mm-hmm.
you know, this is very touching.
Yes, it's very touching. Well, thank you very much. It couldn't have been said better. I appreciate the time you gave me, and it was a pleasure talking to you. And